or
yeah,
yeah, cool. So yeah, thanks for coming this evening. I'm not going to give Danny much of an introduction because I personally don't think he needs one, and I'm just going to let him talk about what I think's a really good contribution to discussions that we're having at the moment. It's a really live issue, so
thank you. Thank you, Connor. Thanks ever so much for the invitation to come here. There's a book. We're not trying to sell you any, because I haven't bought any here. It was only published 2 days ago. There's quite a lot of news 2 days ago. There was a vote about something, and you know, people were getting all excited. But just to reassure you, Sally and I, Sally Thomas is my co-author, have been worrying about this issue for 2 years, ever since the result of the Brexit vote. And we're going to give you a particular, well, I'm going to give you a particular take, as I imagine Sally's here as well, trying to work out why. And this is going back. You know, what was the reason behind the reason behind the reason behind the reason for where we find ourselves today? Now, obviously, me and Sally have a particular take. We have a particular bias. You're about to receive it. I promise you, you will not have to put up with it for more than 40 minutes. I will stop in 40 minutes from now, because always the most interesting thing when talking about Brexit is the questions. The other thing I'll say at the beginning, but you will have forgotten about it in 40 minutes' time, is that most people are not like me, and most people are not like you. That they don't care as much about this issue as you and I care. So things can get quite passionate about it, but the level of passion, I think, is higher in talks about Brexit than in the population as a whole at the moment. It's really interesting because, you know, in the next few weeks, will people actually start becoming more interested in politics than most people are? You have to remember that over 25% of people didn't bother to vote in the first time in their lives. They'd be given a vote that would actually definitely count. Most of you, if you live in a parliamentary constituency, which is fairly predictable over what's it going to be, your vote isn't that important. Only about 10% of people live in marginal constituencies. Only about 10% of people have votes that are crucial to determine elections. The referendum was different. Didn't matter where you lived in the country, your vote actually mattered. Let me zoom on. Apologies, these are a new set of slides. There's only 14 of them, but they're a little bit gee-whizzy, and they may not work. We may get an interesting pause halfway through when I tested them. What you saw there was a couple of book covers. I'm obsessed by inequality. And you could say, oh, maybe the reason why Britain is the first country since Greenland to try and leave the European community, now the European Union, is because of how unequal you are. These graphs are showing you changes over time since 1910 to 2010 about the share of incomes of the best off people in the country. Now the best off tenth. Who's in the best off tenth, by the way? Put your hands up. Go on. Be brave. Well done. Hiya. Come on. All right. It's at least twice as many as that in the audience. But it's not because you're lying. You just won't know. You'll think, oh, I can't be in the best off 10. If you've got a household income of about over 45,000, and there's two of you, and that's the total, you're in the best off 10. You're definitely in the best off 10 up here, because it's a lot cheaper living up here than it is down in Oxford or London. If you're a pensioner and you happen to own your own house, you don't need anything like £45,000 to be in the best off 10th. The best off 10th, I'm definitely in the best off 10th. We take 40% of all income every year. We leave 60% of all income to everybody else in the country. Nowhere else in Europe, apart from Lithuania, annoyingly, nowhere else in Europe is as unequal as that. This is the OECD Gini coefficient of ours. There are lots of OECD countries. These are the strange ones. These are the weird ones. The Latin American ones, Mexico and Chile, they're actually getting better. The inequality is the highest there in the OECD, but it's declining at the moment. But they're still odd countries. Chile spends more money as a share of its education spending on private education than any other country in the OECD. Chile's an utterly divided country. Mexico, if you go there, it really matters where you live and where you don't live. Turkey. Turkey's an interesting country if you know anything about the politics of Turkey at the moment. If you go to Istanbul at the moment, you'll see huge numbers of banners of the great leader, which are all over the city in Istanbul. The United States, bless them, don't yet have huge banners of President Trump all over the place. But come the winning of his second term as president, and you never know what might be going on in the United States. The Baltic states are different, they're small, they particularly didn't like communism. Interestingly, communism ended up with Russia. Russia managed in just 10 years to achieve the level of economic inequality that it took us 1,000 years to get to. And certainly the wealth distribution that we saw from Norman the Conqueror onwards. Anyway, Russia is a highly unequal country with a despotic political leader. We can argue about that if you like. I'm just trying to point out these are weird countries. And next to Russia, almost identically unequal to Russia by income, is the United Kingdom. We are the Texas of Europe. This is not the controversial part of the talk. You may be thinking you don't like this, but these are simply well accepted. This is OECD statistics. And we're slightly more unequal than Israel. That's Israel including the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The way in which we value each other, the way we're willing to pay some people very little and other people a lot, is a bigger difference than the way that Israelis and Palestinians view and treat each other. But we're used to it. We smile and we queue and we carry on, and this is Britain, and the apple pie is nice, and the national parks are good. I'm just trying to start you off with a particular kind of story. Why, of all the European countries, might it have been this one, and then Latvia? But then you ask the question, why again? Why did the UK become the most economically unequal country in Europe? It's really hard for a large country to actually get to the top of a league table. The large European countries are Spain, Italy, France, Germany, and us. And we're not just more unequal than them. We don't just have more poverty than any of those. More people in dire straits in terms of housing, worse health, lower life expectancy, higher infant mortality than all those countries. The average median family in France is €4,000 a year better off, and that's even before you look at how much their housing costs, which is less, and their housing quality is better. And it's warmer, but that isn't, it was always going to be warmer. Why did we become so unequal? We weren't that unequal in the 1970s. In the 1970s, we had the lowest rate of inequality of large European countries apart from Sweden. I can see why you could make an argument. In fact, I may have made it had I been a little bit older than 6 years old in 1974. I can see why you might make an argument back then for not going in with the European community. Why did we need to? We were a great country in the 1970s. The life expectancy of Sheffield was better than national average. We still had near full employment. Why would you want to join this capitalist club of nasty mainland Europeans? I've got some sympathy for that. But between the point at which we joined and the point we find ourselves now, we did this thing. We climbed up that cliff. We rewarded the people who had most with more and more and more and more. And we didn't do it because we joined the European community. The European community is home to more of the most equal countries in the world than anywhere else. Finland, Norway, Netherlands, and more of the happiest countries in the world than anywhere else. If you want to argue that the European community and membership of it makes a country be a certain way, you've got to explain Finland. And not just Finland, you've got to explain the vast majority of them. We are weird. We did something weird. And the question is, why did we do the weird thing? I'm not saying, by the way, that inequality is the main reason that people voted to leave. In fact, I'm going to try quite hard not to ascribe a reason as to why people voted. One fascinating thing about this event is it's exposed how little us academics know. We're quite good at pretending we know a lot. That's our kind of job. Our job is mainly to pretend we know a lot, so we convince students that their £9,000 a year is worth it. And after pretending we know a lot, it actually helps if we do know a lot, because it's much easier to pretend you do if you do. So the kind of thing academics do, if they're studying in general elections, is you write academic papers, which are very like the other papers on elections, but you say something ever so small has changed. And the papers are all very similar to each other, because we've kind of agreed it's the economy stupid, the middle class vote conservative, and nobody embarrasses themselves. Brexit comes along, and we've seen nothing like it before. What do the academics do? They all sit down and quickly write their papers. Do the papers look like anything like an academic paper before? No, because they've got no model to go on. And so the interesting thing is that people write lots of different explanations for what happened with the same data. Something about empire, we need to say something about empire. Everybody thinks they know what the empire is and why it mattered. But when you're on the winning side, you never have to rewrite your history, and we have been on the winning side. Well, if you do have to rewrite your history to a more truthful form of history, you do it very slowly, very late, and it is very painful. I won't read out these quotes, I'll just leave them up for a little bit. And I'm sure we will disagree, there'll be disagreements in this room about what the empire was, whether it's a good thing, what might have been bad about it. But the point is that when it sort of came to an end, it didn't come to an end crashing with a national humiliation from losing a war and a young generation taking over who had absolutely no respect for their elders who wrote new books about the past, as in Germany after the Second World War. It ended in a kind of very slow and polite way, particularly as far as we're concerned. When I did geography A level at school, I had a big, thick textbook which taught me where rubber and tin and iron came from and how rivers work. Because what I was being taught in the 1980s in secondary school was how to run a colony. Because that is what the geography curriculum had been. That's why we created the discipline of geography in Britain. It was the discipline of how to run an empire. And this wasn't any old empire. This is the biggest empire the world has ever known, empire. You may think, oh, well, it kind of goes and it doesn't leave a legacy, but maybe it does. My friend Sally wanted these in. She normally does this part of the talk, but I will do it. People talk about attitudes and the kind of attitudes you get from an empire past, and often they're talking about people who are poorer. But I think it's important, particularly if you're in a university, to point out that quite posh middle-class students are just as capable of being racist and bigoted and arrogant. Mine from the University of Oxford, the news today is that our wonderful students' union have just invited the niece of Le Pen to come and speak. For some reason, our students' union at Oxford feel obliged to invite fascist after fascist to come and give them a platform in the city of Oxford. It's not very clever or impressive behaviour. It will result in yet another new protest. If we're very lucky, there'll be advice from the authorities and a travel ban will actually be issued and it won't happen, is my view. But I've just put those stories up. You know, it's not other people, it's us who hold views which are related to the fact that we, not too long ago, controlled a quarter of the world, and to control that quarter of the world, we had to believe we were superior. Otherwise, why on earth were we going, invading, taking over, being in charge, if there wasn't something very special about us? Nobody invited us. I don't know if it's news, I don't know if any of the students in the audience, but as later were told at school, we weren't invited in anywhere. We have invaded more countries than any other country in the world has ever invaded. And we didn't leave willingly, either. The first colony to get freedom were the 13 states in America. And after they won their freedom, we would have described them as terrorists, we burnt down the White House. After they got their freedom, we got really vicious, because we weren't going to let anybody else escape. Now maybe we thought we weren't doing it for the good of the rest of the world, but it did a hell of a lot for us. We became the richest country in the world. We had terms of trade, which meant that people had to buy things from us. People talk about the competitiveness of Britain falling. We weren't competitive when we were building those ships in the first place. There wasn't a choice. We weren't being competitive when we took people from one continent and shipped them over to another continent, the Americas, to pick cotton, to ship back to here, to mill in this country, to then put in a ship again and take to India to sell. And when we stopped the Indians having their own textile industry so that we could actually sell it. And we weren't being competitive in some kind of free trade way when we sent gunboats to China, because they had the tenacity to refuse to buy the opium we were growing in India. The British Empire, in a way, was bigger than the actual formal empire and what we did. Every Chinese student in school is taught that the British were the biggest drug dealers in the world and destroyed Chinese civilization for a century. Not a single child in British schools is taught about this kind of thing. I'm laying it on a bit fast and thick, but that's because I promised you I'm not going to talk for that long. There's a map. That's the empire. I'll leave it on for couple of minutes. It's the empire drawn in a strange way. The circles of a country, the size of the country has covered population, but India was always big. The first date is Sally's best guess at when we first went in significantly. The end date is when we were asked or agreed to leave. People often talk about the Commonwealth being some kind of possible future for Britain. But if the Commonwealth thought that the Commonwealth was actually an important political entity in future, they would have picked a future leader from India. Or the other thing to ask yourself about the Commonwealth is, what do we sell to India? We sell far, far less to India than we buy from India. The picture there is the last colony going, Hong Kong. And we told ourselves a story about that, which isn't true. I mean, I can talk about the other stories of Hong Kong, but who in the audience, I've got a view about the age group, who is old enough to remember the young woman crying as we left? A few of you. You are younger on average. And you know, and the story was that she cried. This is the daughter of Chris Patten, the last governor of Hong Kong, Chancellor of my university. The trope was that she was crying as the sun set and the flag went down on the last colony of a wonderful thing. Prince Charles is just off the edge of the picture. In the book, we've managed to get Prince Charles in there. Poor Prince Charles is a young Prince Charles, standing on the edge going, what the hell do I do? I don't deal with women, particularly ones who are crying. She wasn't crying because Hong Kong was no longer going to be a colony. She cried for 3 hours that day. She was crying because she was told she had to leave her boyfriend. She's written this up later. And if you like, that's the kind of least painful story about our history we're going to have to start telling. Migration. These are figures from British censuses. Every census since 1841, the first census in which we recorded where people were born, is about people living in Britain at each census date and how many millions were born in another country and where they were born from. And we're just stacking the different origins on so you get an idea about how it becomes more varied over time. Ireland was the oldest colony of Britain. We didn't treat Ireland particularly well. Let's just leave it at that. But unless you have a particular interest in Ireland, you will not know that. Because we do not teach in our schools and universities how we treated Ireland. We do not point out that I think Ireland is still the only place in the world with a lower population than it had 160 years ago. We have something to do with that. There was a kind of rough justice in the fact that Ireland is now so important to what is currently happening. And of course we got all these people because we were the hub of an empire when we wanted them. Enoch Powell went out to the Caribbean to beg people to come and be nurses and bus drivers before a few years later he said there was a problem. And each time they came, we said how terrible it was they were coming with their diseases and their strange attitudes and behaviour. All those terrible Jews coming, 1901, 1905. And then those men from the Caribbean, more men than women on Windrush. And then the terrible Eastern Europeans arriving. We just do it again and again and again. And we say we do it because we have more immigrants than other places and we've been overrun by immigration. Well, here's the data from Eurostat from just before the referendum, 2014. It's a strange map, it's stretched so that every area is proportional to population, otherwise you're just looking at mountains. The yellow areas are where less than 5% of the population were born in another country. We are currently sitting in a yellow area. Not the city of York and certainly not the university, but Yorkshire as a whole, probably less than 5%. And everybody says, oh, but what about the Somalis? Oh, and the Roma in Sheffield. Anyway, didn't get into that. The dark blue areas are where 20% or more of the population was born abroad. And our only dark blue area on the mainland of Britain is part of London. That's the only bit with 20% or more born abroad. Outside of the mainland in Northern Ireland, there's a large area where over 20% were born abroad. They were born in the Republic. We at least have had a wonderful education over the last 2 years that you put a yoghurt pot on that border and you are in trouble. That's the one thing I think we've learned. We didn't realise what we had signed when we signed the Good Friday Agreement or why. And at least we've learned that. But we are a country of relatively low immigration. And that immigration is concentrated in the parts of the country that voted for Remain. Northern Ireland, London. If you look at the rest of Europe, Switzerland has much higher immigration, partly because of its shape. But down here, Spain, that big blob is Madrid. Spain's had a really significant migration. Must have destroyed its local culture. Now you can guess who the biggest migrant group are. If you're lucky, very soon, if we go for hard Brexit, you're going to meet them. But you're only going to meet them once they were ill. Because they'll have to come back here to use the health service because they won't be able to use the health service in Spain because they are British citizens, not Spanish citizens. And of course they're not immigrants because we never produce immigrants, we only ever produce expats. But there's your pattern. It wasn't immigration. It was certainly the fear of immigration. So why are people so frightened about immigration? They're frightened about immigration because they're told constantly that the reason the schools are not good enough is the immigrants, and the reason the houses cost so much is the immigrants, and the reason the jobs aren't well paid is the immigrants, and the reason the National Health Service has a queue is the immigrants. Because it's very convenient to tell that story rather than to say actually it's because the top 10% are taking 40% of all income. Voting. This little squiggly graph. It's voting for far-right parties, UKIP, BNP, National Front, all added together. Referendum Party back in 1997, James Goldsmith sent a video to every house in the country, and about 2% of the vote. So it's really tiny. European election in 1999, 2003 it's going up, 2004, look at that. Oh, it's dropped again. Voting for far-right parties dropped in 2005 and 6. 2007 was really low. 2008 is pretty miserable. Well, bang, 2009. It's another European election. Down in 2010, down in 2011, down in 2012. Up a little bit, I think, 2013. Another European election, 2014, it's way up there. So the squiggles in the graph, if you're nerdy, the x-axis is the speed of change, the y-axis is the overall support. It's now right down at 2% UKIP and the rest of the far right. There wasn't a settled long view of the British slowly getting more and more annoyed and voting for really anti-European parties, the anger was stoked up before European elections by a press that stoked it up. The graph at the bottom, if anybody's particularly nerdy, is the proportion of people who voted for a party to the right of mainstream European Conservatives. Because one thing none of us noticed, I never noticed it in 2014, is by 2014 our Conservative Party had left the EPP main Tory bloc in Europe and had joined a far-right group. Together, the Conservatives that we send to the mainland, to the Parliament, and UKIP, are the biggest bulk of far-right MEPs in the Parliament. We, this country, is the far-right bastion of the European community. We don't see ourselves like that, because we're ever so polite and civil. But people on the far-right in Finland, people in Hungary, they couldn't get funding because they couldn't match themselves up with MEPs if we were not in the Parliament. 2014 European election, 50.2% of people who voted for a party to the right of European Conservatives in this country. I'm sorry about the number of graphs, we have cut them down. This is a graph by age, and it's showing that actually the people who are most likely to vote for Remain are slightly younger than me, 35 to 44 year olds. The young really didn't get out of bed, 25s, 18 to 24 year olds. You just look at the size of the proportion who didn't vote. But it's it's age. The older you are, the more likely you are to vote to leave. The green line is the falling value of the pound over time, over a century. This was the richest country in the world. When my granddad was born, you could get $5 to the pound. When my mum was born, you could get $4. When I was born, you could get $3. When my oldest child was born, you could get $2. We're heading towards $1. We're heading towards parity with the euro. I first went to France at age 15 on a school trip. And you got 10 francs, which is the equivalent of a euro, to the pound. 10 to the pound. With £1, you could buy, as a 15-year-old boy, 3 bottles of wine. It really was. We were kings. And in Gatwick this summer, I think it was £1.17 to buy a euro if you're silly enough to buy them at the last minute. The older you are, the bigger the fall you've seen in the relative status of this country. And you've been told that the reason for the fall was the trade unions or socialism or the British disease or something else. The main reason for the fall is that we were unnaturally and incredibly powerful and rich when we controlled the largest empire in the world. And when the colonies gained their independence, we could no longer encourage them to buy our goods, and they bought somebody else's. And this is what happened. But we didn't tell ourselves this is what happened. So we get this on election day. We get this most incredible map. This is just showing you, my friend likes sea monsters. It's not like any other map. It's not a map of literacy or poverty or anything else. It's quite remarkable. And this is the one thing I definitely know. I don't know why any of you voted. You might, by the time you've heard so much about me, have an idea about why I voted. The only thing we know is how many people in each area voted Leave, Remain, or did not vote. And even that has been misreported. So the story that you're told is that it was poor Northerners who voted Leave, as they panned in on that shot of that blonde woman and her two men with no hair in Sunderland on the night. Middlesbrough, Stoke and so on, they voted Leave. The South didn't want to vote Leave, but it's because we've been nasty to poor people in the North. Utterly wrong. Easily proved wrong. The majority of Leave voters lived in the south of England. And not just that. More people voted Leave in Essex than in all those areas put together, which have a larger electorate than Essex. More people voted Leave in Hampshire, despite Hampshire having fewer voters, than in the combined areas of Bolsover, Doncaster, Hull, Chesterfield, Salford, Stoke-on-Trent and Sunderland. No, Stoke and Sunderland. Nobody's yet gone to Hampshire and said, why do you do it? Winchester is Leeds Central. This is not, this is easy to show. The problem is that Winchester is where your mum and dad live, if you're a presenter of the BBC Newsnight programme. And you don't really want to say it's my parents that did it, I think. There's Kent. More people voted than Kent's. Well, Kent's not going to do very well out of this unless you're going to sell sandwiches to lorry drivers waiting a long time. And that. You know, more Lee voters are in Rotherham. Sheffield. Sheffield's enormous. This is partly because turnout was lower, but it's also because Leeds Central is the south of England. Why have so many Conservative MPs wanted to leave for so long? They're representing people who want to leave for so long, most of whom are in the south. This is easy to show because we know where people were. I have a 50-minute lecture which consists only of these maps. Right, I call it the most boring lecture in the world. I like giving it. And I take every single county in the south of England. So in this case, Somerset, where 288,000 people voted to leave, with an electorate of 710,000 people. And I compare it to a set of areas with a larger electorate, 729,000 people, where fewer voted to leave. And that larger area to Somerset is the combined districts of Darlington, Harrogate, Stockton, Hartlepool, Middlesbrough, Hambleton, and here in York. Now, Middlesbrough, Hartlepool, it's always the poorer ones that kind of get blamed. York sort of university said 42%. But more people voted leave in Somerset than up here. And I do it again and again, always choosing different areas, so I am not cheating. And for every single county in the south of England, I can find you a set of areas in Wales and the north of Scotland and Northern Ireland. And I include Gibraltar, because I am slightly on the spectrum. Everywhere. Even Gibraltar. In England, the city of London was the most Maine. But actually, Gibraltar's far more than Maine. Anyway. It's a childish thing. But believe you me, the south, in every case, voted leave more. Here's some of the correlations that were produced. This is my favourite one. The academic who produced this one at the top was pilloried. He found a 0.8 correlation between obesity and voting leave. And then naively tried to come up with reasons as to why and claimed that people who are fat are a bit more lazy and don't think. And I'm allowed to talk about this because I am of the size of the people he's talking about. Why would you get a correlation between obesity and voting leave? I think the best guess, and you could try and look into it, it's hard, is immigration. The correlation with immigration is 0.79. The correlation with obesity is 0.8. You're basically looking at something that's very closely related to immigration. Why might immigration be related to obesity? Migrants tend to be young, fit, thin, and healthy. And if they turn up in your area, not only did they make your area less obese, they make you feel fat. Believe me, I live in Oxford. And people who live in areas where migrants move to tend to get thinner. People who live in areas where nobody turns up tend to get fatter. That's my guess. The correlation of deprivation is 0.03. There is none. Not about deprivation. And I can go on and on with graphs. Let me just tell you the important thing here. These are English constituencies divided into 10 groups. From the poorest 10th, most deprived, to the richest 10th. Now, which Briton voted Remain? If you go skiing twice a year at Christmas, you know, you really want to be in the European Union. So that's certainly true. But if you ignore the top 10th, then the strongest leave areas are the middle Briton. It's the middle three sets of constituencies. Essentially, if you want to stereotype, it is middle-aged and older Conservative voters living in the south of England, not in the very poshest constituencies. People who think he is a man to be made leader. What's going to happen now? and why have we got to this point? Standard & Poor produced this particular graph, not with Nigel on it, but my friend who helped with the slides thinks you might be a bit bored of the graphs by now. Standard & Poor produced this graph, I think, 2 or 3 weeks before the election. And it's their estimate of who would be most affected, whichever countries will be most affected if Britain would leave. And the really important thing is, A, they got it right, which is quite worrying that they're that good, but B, none of the large countries are anywhere near this end of the scale. It doesn't matter to them. I have a friend who works in Bloomberg in Chile, and I asked him what are Bloomberg doing about Brexit. He says, it doesn't affect the world economy whether Britain leaves or not. It's very painful to hear. The most affected country is Ireland. But actually, Ireland could do quite well out of this. If you look at the cranes in Dublin or the 5,000 jobs in Barclays that have just moved to Dublin, if you are the only large English-speaking country left in the EU, you're going to get companies who want staff who speak English, who want their children to grow up speaking English. Malta, it's too small. Luxembourg, again, it's not that powerful. Cyprus, Switzerland isn't in the EU. Belgium's tiny, Netherlands isn't big. When we thought we were going into negotiations, we didn't look at the Standard & Poor graph about who was going to be most affected. The Germans can find other people to buy their cars. Even with growth in China dropping to 7.5% a year, they can find other people actually make their cars in China anyway. Sorry. Trying to light that up. So, reactions. Here's the first big reaction, which is the last election, the election in 2017. And this is the conventional swing. And again, this isn't often explained. Attlee got a swing in 1945, which was enormous. And Labour lost the next election. They did quite a lot between 1945 and 50. You might have heard of some of the things they did, and I won't talk about them. Blair got a big swing in 1997. Didn't leave. But part of the reason, didn't lose the next election, but part of the reason that Blair got such a big swing in 1997 is there had been 18 years of Conservative rule by that time. He did badly in the next election, minus 2.5. He did badly in the next election, minus 5.5. Gordon Brown in 2010, admittedly he'd just been in charge with the worst financial crisis since 1929, but poor old Gordon Brown managed to lose a swing of 6.2%. And then we got Ed Miliband. And Ed Miliband was absolutely brilliant. Ed Miliband was lovely. He loved to walk and talk. He noticed I can't walk and talk. I stand still. Ed couldn't walk and talk at first. He took a lot of training. He cared. He tried really hard. And he got a 1.4% swing. And that is really, really good for a Labour leader, if you look at the history of the graph. Right? It's just, it's not enough. And you need it again and again and again and again to win power. And what does this strange, bumbling man who can't do a sound bite and goes to funerals when he shouldn't be going there and whatever else he does, what happens with him? It's 9.6%. And even better, he gets 9.6% and doesn't win. Which means you don't disappoint, because whenever you win, you can't actually deliver the land, the milk and honey you promised. So that's stacked up. And then the question is, what happens next? Well, what happens next is, no matter how much you dislike Theresa May, if you're in the Conservative Party, you do not vote against her in a vote of confidence, because you know about this. So you wouldn't dare go for a general election. That squiggly graph there is showing how fast the swing in April, May and June 2017. And you'll have to believe me, and you might believe me because you've realised how boring I am by now. I've drawn 2,000 of these graphs. There's been no other swing in months as fast as that ever in British polling history. The unprecedented happened. And once the unprecedented has happened, you don't know what is possible next. And we're in this really fractious position. Except we're ever so polite. And that might have something to do with empire. We don't like to disappoint, we follow orders, we behave ourselves, everything worked out when we did. Half of all French adults have been on a protest You're not really French if you haven't been on a protest. Right? We shouldn't be shocked about the protest in France now. It's what you do if you're French. Spain, Italy, Denmark, over a third. Germans are twice as likely to protest than we are. We don't protest. We are remarkably pliant and well-behaved. And so we don't know what's going to happen. Drawing to a close, so please think of any questions. This is my last slide. And I'm leaving up, just trying to get you to think about how much things have changed in the last few years. And whether, if that had happened 5 or 10 years ago, would there have been the same reaction to it happening that occurred last year? I think attitudes are changing in this country remarkably quickly. I think the Conservative Party is moving to the left. It's taxing landlords like it never did before. It's doing a number of things quite slowly. Labour, I think it's not hard to argue, it's moving to the left. I think we're changing in our attitudes of what we think of as decent and good behaviour. And part of me is optimistic. My mother, as a teenager, went to a meeting in Leeds Town Hall because of something called the Suez Crisis. And what a bungling mistake the Conservatives were making over this because of their attitudes, partly because of the empire, about how superior they were. And she joined the Labour Party because things had to change and they were going to change way back in 1956. And it all felt a bit awful in 56 and 57 and 58. But then it began to change. And you got the 1960s. And you got attitudes that were different. And young people didn't respect their elders because their elders had made numerous mistakes and had attitudes that were stuck in the past. Now this is much, much bigger than Suez. But there's no reason why out of this, and I'm sure you're going to ask me so I'll tell you my prediction about how it goes, but my base prediction is whatever happens, it's going to be bad. In a way, we're going to have to cope with less, whatever happens. But out of that, there is no reason why we cannot become a more grown-up country, one that better understands its history, one that jettisons some of the more stupid ideas that we might have had about ourselves, particularly the superiority one, which really, really has to go. A country which looks at its education system. I told you Chile spent the most on private education in the OECD. We're number two. They don't do it on the mainland. Does it produce wonderfully articulate and able politicians who are ever so clever? Or does it produce a bumbling mess of people with attitudes of superiority who think they are born to lead? I think it is completely understandable and almost forgivable that Britain is the way it is. I think all former empires go through this. I think there's no need to think we are particularly stupid or odd. We were put in a circumstance because of where and when most of us were born, which people in Germany and Spain and France have not been put in. And we're playing out a role in that. But we could get something very good coming out of this in future, because we're rapidly learning more about ourselves. We're learning what we're worth, because we've been in the negotiation. We're learning where stuff comes from, and we're learning who wants to get what we produce and what we can actually do that will make enough money to bring the food in to keep ourselves going. Thank you for letting me waffle on with you for that length. Please think of some questions. Thank you.
Right, have we got any questions at all, or...? You are. Right. Oh. Sorry. Oh, bloody hell.
Do you think that, should there be a second referendum, 16 to 18-year-olds should be given the opportunity to vote, given that they missed out the first time around?
Yes, I would definitely give them the opportunity to vote. They're given the opportunity to vote in Scotland. there's not some magical biological thing that happens differently between 16 and 18. The magical biological thing tends to happen between 11 and 14. And it's earlier. We send them to fight. We let them marry. I think we should. But one danger is, of course, that they're all on Facebook and Snapchat and Instagram. So they're highly targetable. Whereas the elderly, Cambridge Analytica didn't get to the very elderly, because believe you, the very elderly are really not on Facebook.
You said you were optimistic about the future and suggesting that people are beginning to think differently. Yeah. What actual evidence have you got to back that up?
Okay. The election swing, that is a very big and unprecedented thing that happens, the swing of the election. Changing in reporting by the BBC. So, and often people think the BBC is the other way. People of my political disposition tend to think of the BBC as this terrible conservative organisation. But if you can think back to 2006 and 2007, the BBC would routinely show stories of bankers celebrating big deals, drinking bottles of champagne in London, one of which, my favourite one, was they paid £30,000 for a big magnum of champagne. And they had a diamond in it worth £10,000, but the rest, £20,000, they were going to drink away. And that was a BBC business story. That kind of celebration of our wealth makers has reduced as it becomes an untenable and silly story to make. The Director General of the BBC is now paid much less. But I'll give you one example. Take the two highest paid men last year. Martin Sol of WPP was encouraged to leave his job, and suddenly the highest paid man was no longer the highest paid man. And I've forgotten the name of the builder. He gets on 80 million a year. A BBC reporter said to him something like, "Do you think you're really worth that much money?" And he says, and it's on camera, it's out there. He says, "I really don't think you should have asked that question," in quite a menacing way. He was gone 3 weeks later. University vice chancellors are at the top of taking 1% pay rises, the clever ones, rather than 20% pay rises. It's not enough. And you really know you're getting change when people are angry and say it's not enough. Top CEOs 2 years ago had an average pay cut reported by the High Pay Commission of £1 million each. The ratio of workers to CEO pay fell. The only reporting of it was The Guardian, and their reporting was they're still paid too much. And I'm an optimist, it's only just begun since 2008, but it looks to me a little bit like what happened after 1929, when our attitudes to wealth creators and the idea that we could allow the rich to run our lives and it would make everybody else's lives better, that attitudes change. So it's in those kind of pay differences. But on the other hand, you see people coming out with far more obvious and virulent racism than they would be willing to have come out before the referendum. You know, there are more nasty views, more publicly expressed than there would have been. There's the mic.
Do you think if there is a hard Brexit, it will lead to Scottish independence and unification in Ireland, which some people would see as the final part of the decolonisation process? Yeah.
We may get that anyway. Even if we were to revoke, well, not we, only one person can revoke Article 15 as Prime Minister. And they don't need to ask anybody else. I say they, because it doesn't have to be a she, because you can get another Prime Minister in before 29th of March. The only person who can revoke Article 50 is Prime Minister. They simply send a letter, and that's it. You could call it delaying if you like, but then you need the other 27 to agree. But if you simply send a letter, we'll revoke. If hard Brexit or a badly bungled, shabby deal, Scotland goes for an independence referendum as soon as it can, because it wants to keep the kind of anger. You know, you don't want to leave it too late to go. In a way, we've already got, it's controversial to say it, we have Irish unification. That was the Good Friday Agreement, partly. We don't honour it. So there were journalists who hold a passport from Republic of Ireland, we're still being treated like we treated people from the Windrush, despite the fact we're supposed to honour those passports in Britain, because that border is not there. The border actually went with the Good Friday Agreement. Unification is then separating for Britain, but the border went. And that's what we find really hard to understand. And I guess our politicians, Blair, was very clever. So when we did sign the Good Friday Agreement, it wasn't explained that this was partly unification. It was certainly explained in the Republic it was. It was explained that this was a way of averting some of the worst violence seen outside Yugoslavia on the whole of the continent since the Second World War. It's an odd union of four countries. Scotland joined England at a time when it was economically opportune to, when it became obvious that if you worked together, you could make a lot more money, initially about by funding pirates to attack Spanish galleons, but then by forming an empire. It was a marriage of convenience between Scotland and England. Rule Britannia, the song, was commissioned by a German-speaking prince of England after the unification to be sung to create this myth. We didn't use the word Britain before the unification. We'd had no British coins for 1,500 years. We now think of Britain as this thing that's existed for a long time, but it didn't. My view is that the union is a very, very dodgy union. And part of the reason why Wales and Scotland got their parliaments is moving away. My preference about it would be that the whole of the continent does this with the large countries. Spain is not a happy country as a single country. Germany has partly done it with the federal system that's imposed. France is not a happy country with the power of Paris compared to what's happening in other areas. My personal feeling is that 60 million people is a bit too much to treat in one block, but that's just mine. And in the end of the book, we have a thing called the Heineken map. Freddy Heineken, who made the beers, commissioned two historians to produce a future map of Europe. And he commissioned it before the breakup of Yugoslavia. And he got the breakup of Yugoslavia, or rather the historians did, almost spot on. And for the UK, he has the United Ireland, and he has a separate Scotland. I'm trying to remember exactly what he does here. I think it was very clever. I'll have to check. He definitely has Yorkshire. But it's capital, I may be wrong, it's in the book and I can't remember. He may have put the capital of Yorkshire being Newcastle. So he's trying to placate, which wouldn't quite work. Where's this one?
Hi there. That was brilliant, thank you. You suggest the connection between our empire and attitudes to race and immigration.
Yeah.
I wonder if you make a comparison to other old imperial powers and their attitudes.
Yeah.
That shows us as bad or worse.
Yeah, we say a little about that. We were bigger. We've got a lot about Kipling in this. Dominic Cummings loves Kipling, by the way. And so we have lots and lots about ours. I mean, kind of, thankfully for us, the Belgians were even worse. You know, cut the hands off so many children, which again we don't teach about that. And the French were pretty bloody and awful in Algeria. So this kind of behaviour, when you're a colonial power, you can't be a colonial power without looking down on the people that you govern and not seeing them as people. I mean, you can't. We do all this teaching about the end of slavery in Wilberforce. We don't teach anything about the beginnings of the mass slave trade across the Atlantic. The difference is, it's not that these attitudes can't be found elsewhere. It's that their empires were absolutely tiny. And the existence of Belgium wasn't based entirely on chocolate and their tiny colonies in Africa. The German state wasn't made by those parts of Africa which are very small that it controlled. Italy, not from Abyssinia, but we were. York, that chocolate factory was there because of some relations with colonies, but the engine works to make train engines wasn't just for engines in Britain, it was for engines elsewhere in our colonies. We are so central. We're like Rome and the Roman Empire, just bigger. And that wasn't the same experience for the other small empires at all.
On behalf of all the older people of this country, especially in the south, I apologise. However, I'm in the north and I voted to remain. I came because I'm concerned about... I need some clarification. We've got... I'm concerned about environmental standards, food standards, I'm concerned about human rights, etc. And my bottom line is, united we stand, divided we fall. However, the problem I have is all these algorithms that are meandering about and persuading everybody to do things, and I'm not on it, and so I am not persuaded at all by anything that goes on like that. However, if you say that... I'm worried about the fact that so many people voted Brexit, and I don't want to override their right to feel that they need a voice and we need to listen to them, etc.
Can you see where I'm coming from? I'm stuck.
I'm stuck between a rock and a hard place, because I can see the shenanigans that are going on in the political, with Parliament, with the Labour and Conservative playing parliamentary games in order to do this, okay, that and the other. How on earth do we get ourselves out of this mess?
Well, the mess is so deep, if we could, it wouldn't be as deep as it is. I mean, to try and cheer you up a bit, in hindsight, suppose it had been 52% Remain, 48% leave. This would be going on and on for even longer. There would be a second referendum, we'll fight for it. Everything would be blamed on immigrants. At least we've stopped blaming everything on immigrants. Largely. It's incredible. Public attitudes, the question earlier. The immigrants for a problem line has absolutely dropped on the surveys. It's amazing how quickly they're not a problem. But they will be blamed. Immigrants will be blamed for the fact they're leaving soon. But one thing is, at least we brought it to a head quicker than we thought we would. So whatever we do, we're going to have to do it a bit faster. This will go on for another 10 years in some kind of way, but it could have gone on for 20 if it hadn't been that actual result. We don't know the reasons for people voting. This was the first chance people got to vote for either keeping things as they are or changing. And lots of people want to change. And the people who want to change by where they live are living in places where things have got a bit run down. And they're often places where you don't think they've got run down. So I did a story for Newsnight in Tewkesbury. And you think of Tewkesbury as a chocolate box kind of town with an abbey and all the rest of it. But the main street is tattoo parlour, charity shops, Poundland. The houses, £340,000. Your grandkids can't possibly buy one on the amount of money they'll be getting. But your grandkids are not even getting a job which is permanent. They're doing a series of temporary jobs. And then, of course, your grandchildren have to go to university, but they're going to be given this enormous debt to go to university, and everything is wrong, and you can't see how it can get better. When I was young, I'm on the older side, I got a mortgage at the age of 23. I had a temporary contract. I bought a lovely three-bed house in Newcastle. I went to university for free. You know, things have got worse, but they've got worse for the middle class in particular, just not the poshest middle class. So we're going to have to bring it to ahead and sort out what we're doing, and we can no longer have a model where we allow a very small number of people to be incredibly rich and the median average person to be living a life which is worse in terms of prospects than their parents. We've got huge advantages. We've got the English language, We've got a continuous stream of tourists. We're going to have to start seeing the tourists as an advantage, because that is the one guaranteed income stream we've got in the future. You could paint a very positive picture of what might be possible. We can get immigrants, again because of English and again because this is an interesting place to come to. That's partly why the nearest hospital to meet, the giant John Radcliffe Hospital in Oxford, only exists because of immigrants. And why are they coming to a city in which they're going to be paid less as a nurse than the rent? Partly so they can put the word Oxford on their CV, but it's partly because all these more equal, more stable, better European mainland countries are often a bit boring. And we there's an interesting side to Britain. There's lots we could do. But what we can't do is what George Osborne promised in 2015, which was, if you follow my economic plan, he said, just 2015, by 2030, we will be the richest country on earth. Now, he did. Why was George Osborne trying to make Britain the richest country on earth? Empire mentality. It's that idea of where you should rightly be. And we've got to get that out. We've got to have an aspiration, I would say, to be the average country by inequality in Europe. We're not going to become the most equal suddenly, but at least we could aim to be the average. We could have an aspiration that our schools are at least as good as European schools. Imagine if our children could speak a second language, actually speak it, in a way in which they could use that second language. We should have an aspiration for our higher education, which is not what it currently is. I won't say any more about that. We should have an aspiration for the stability of jobs and the amount of money you get paid for a job. We should have an aspiration for housing. That's not too hard to solve, because we've got more empty rooms in our houses than ever before. We just don't share them out very well. But a series of basic aspirations to be a decent place to live. And the problem with the empire legacy is that that is seen as not very ambitious, wanting to be average. We are currently going from 17th to 19th in the European league table for infant mortality. If the trend continues, more babies died last year than the year before, more than the year before than the year before, only place in Europe. If that trend continues, we're going to be below Romania on the infant mortality league table of Europe around about 2025. That's why I say we should have an aspiration to be a normal European country, which does far better. On the side of that bus, if Romain had been clever, they would have driven another bus around. And instead of 350 million, it would have said 1 billion a week. Because 1 billion a week is how much extra the Germans pay for their health services than we do. And then we have to ask, well, how do the Germans manage to spend an extra billion on their health services than we spend? It's because they choose not to have aircraft carriers or nuclear missiles. It's because they respect trade unions. And that requires a lot of thinking. But practically, it's entirely possible to be a bit more like the Germans. It's just in our nature to be exceptional. We don't want to be like anybody else. You know, we're different and special, which you are when you're the heart of an empire. There's a question here. Should we do another three or four? Because I know I'm the age when I know about bladders. Okay, go on.
Hi, Dominique. Thanks, that was really fascinating, and I'm popping off with ideas and questions. There's been a suggestion that there's been a period of navel-gazing and false confidence from universities, actually, from the left at times, both here and in the US, and perhaps more widely than that. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about where you think that navel-gazing has come from. Is it a lack of confidence? Is it an arrogance? Is it that culture of protest that you mentioned in your penultimate slide?
About time, things have changed. Our universities have gone in a matter of 10 years from places where you went for £1,000, it may have been free by about 10 years ago, things change, where there was a fixed number of students per university. If you took 0.5% more or 0.5% less, you were fined. It was quite a starless system, but it was fairly fixed. In 2012, the free market was brought in for students to get more than AAB. Now we have a complete free market. Any university can take any number of students. What that does is mean that you desperately try to take as many as you possibly can. You may have a vice of thinking of Exeter, by the way, here, in case you're wondering. Well, Durham. Poor old Durham. The town, I mean, not the university. You may have vice chancellors who are slightly megalomaniac about it. But also, if you don't try and get as many students as you can, you might find you get less, and then you have to lay people off. If you are one of the places getting less, the report comes out by UCAS at the end of this month, we find out who lost last year. If you are one of the places getting less, you don't want to complain about the system because it just draws attention to you. So what we get is gung-ho stupidity. Our university ranks one in this, we're brilliant or whatever. There's an exercise. Click on the web and look at the front page of university websites. And look at the claims being made on the front pages of and look how colourful they are. And then click on the front page of a university website in the Netherlands or in Germany or in France. Just contrast. We have, at my last count, 30 universities in Britain who on their websites claim to be in the top 10. And in one way or another they are, because they carefully pick the ranking. But they have to. And we did it to ourselves. I mean, we have a wonderful advertisement for the rest of the mainland of what not to do. But I don't think we have to carry on being the place that tries out these weird ideas that everything should be a market just to show it fails anymore. I think we've done enough of that. And we should just stop. Universities have been doing quite a lot of planning for Brexit. As far as I'm aware, and I don't know everything, they've been doing hardly any planning for a Labour SNP or just Labour government. The day after a Labour government, there are no more fees and loans. That's in the manifesto. It will be in the next manifesto. But universities, because they can't imagine that, as far as I know, unless they've done a brilliant job of not leaking it, simply assume a Labour government is impossible because it's Jeremy Corbyn and he's mad because he's not like us. We quite like Tony Blair, you know, but we don't like Chesa. And the most likely coalition is with the SNP. And what do the SNP think about fees and loans? They don't have them in Scotland. Fees and loans are going at some point. They're not going to come out of the manifesto. The government is not going to give £9,000 for each student. And the other thing that's probably going to happen, this I've worked on and written on, is that the historic debt is going to have to be partly written off. If you go to university the year before Labour win, your debt will be entirely written off. It's the only thing that's possible. If you went to university 3 years before, it'll be capped at about £4,000. It also happens to be electorally massively advantageous to tell half the population that this debt will go from them if they happen to vote the right way, and if their parents vote the right way, and if they can persuade their grandparents to also vote so they won't have a debt of £70,000 or £80,000.
We heard that before from the Lib Dems, they didn't stick to that.
They didn't stick to it. And I know Labour are worried about the IMF and the idea of what happens. In a way, of course, when the fees and loans go, and if part of the debt is written off, the graduates will still be paying just as much because Labour are going to tax them a lot more. They're just going to tax everybody on that kind of income a lot more, whether you went to university or not. And that's what happens on the European mainland. You earn about €50,000 a year, you're taxed about 50%. It's what you need to pay if you want a good local school and a good local hospital. And if you don't pay that amount in tax, you're not going to have a good local school and a good local hospital. And it's like that. It's just the way it is. Two more questions?
Hi there, yes. I just want to ask you, Danny, what you see as the future for the EU. So, you know, is Brexit like going to have a domino effect, do you think, in any way? And I'm sort of interested in, you know, we're completely obsessed with Brexit here, but yeah. The Europeans are presumably completely fed up with it. And I know there's been a lot of talk about, actually, we want to talk about migration, which is obviously a problem for Europe and has been a problem for Europe for a number of years now in terms of how there's burden sharing or collaboration or whatever you want to call it. And a lot of people think that will make the collaboration potentially fall over in any case. So I just wonder what your thoughts are on that.
A lot of people here did, and at the time of the referendum, and I've got lots of good friends in Greece, I went to the cash point on Lesbos with one of my best friends in Greece when he hadn't been paid for 3 months. At the point he finally managed to get his 800 euros to live for 3 months on, as a university senior lecturer. But what's happened since Brexit has been utterly amazing. So the Germans have started treating Greece slightly better. The situation in Greece has got much, much better than it was. You no longer have people not able to get their salaries anymore. We have done a brilliant job of demonstrating that if you have even the tiniest scrap of a land border, you're kind of stuck in this, which wasn't obvious before. So Greece even has a land border with Bulgaria, I think. And you may think, oh, that shouldn't matter. But you only have to give people 10 years without a border. And they start to spread over it. And they form relationships with other people, and they marry, and there's a firm that makes things there and takes it over there. And that wasn't obvious until we now. The only other place we left was Greenland. And they really didn't have a land border, and they were a long way away. And they had lots of fish. And because they have lots of fish, the EU, differently named then, negotiated for 3 years with Finland, and we still pay 500 euros a year for every child in Finland, in between Greenland, and they can still come and work in the EU. They got a good deal. But I think the chances of countries breaking away are much less. The country that either is going, always going to come back with its tail between its legs, Britain, is the country most responsible for making the EU the thing that people most dislike. So we were, because we're the most right-wing large country in Europe, we were the people making it the rich men's club that always brought in these rules saying the market is at the top and you can't do various things. That was us above everybody else. And the regulations? Do you want to guess who brought in more European-led regulations? Who likes regulations? Think about it. Who has really weird-shaped electrical plugs? And, you know, we like rules. All those European regulations. That was us. So you take the UK out. You take Nigel Farage off the Parliament. And then, could the EU become a nicer place? I would like to remain in. But I'm a bit worried about sending MEPs to the Parliament in May. If Article 50 was cancelled, I suspect part of the backlash and the very polite civil war we'll get is that UKIP would send a majority of MEPs to the European Parliament in May if we were allowed to have MEPs. If we don't leave, we have to take part in European elections. And that's the next nightmare to come. But I'm optimistic, more optimistic for the EU27 with us having done this than if we had voted 52% Remain. I think you could then see places breaking away more easily. You asked about the Syrians. And the contrast, I mean, the real crisis for the Syrians is the 3 million in Turkey, of whom 1.5 million, half of them are children, and almost none of them have been to school, some not to school for 7 years. That's the biggest migrant crisis. A teenage girl cries in front of Angela Merkel. Brilliant, she cried in front of Angela Merkel, and they take in over 1.2 million. Truly, and there's a way of dealing with your history, if you like. And that's still quite incredible, and it's still working. And there are still people in tents under flyovers in Germany, but it's shocking, they should have been shared out more. Who looks after the interests of Hungary and Europe more than anybody else? It's us. We are the friends of the fascist Hungarians, who've just brought in their slave labour law for their own people. Why have Hungary brought in a slave law? You have to work in Hungary overtime and won't be paid for 3 years if you didn't know about this. Because they've stopped the immigrants coming in, who would have done the work? the last time we produced two children per couple is, I think, at the very end of the 1960s, anywhere in Europe. The pill arrived in Germany in 1961 for us. Europe has not been reproducing itself for 50 years. 1.3 children per couple in Italy. Below one in Barcelona. We were the highest, we were at 1.9. Unprecedented. That's partly because we had young women of the right age who had come from elsewhere in Europe, who were going back with their children. When you have fewer and fewer children, you've got a problem. You know, I want to spend my final year, whenever it is, in a bed, in a nursing home, with somebody who actually wants to be putting the catheter in and out of me. And that requires enough people, and it requires them to be paid enough, because otherwise it's going to be the most awful year of my life. And that's the same for all of us. You know, you need more people. You don't need less people. You know something's going badly wrong in your area if nobody's turning up, and if they're leaving. So in a way, Europe doesn't have a migrant crisis. The migrants who've come in are still not enough to make up for the population fall that's going to come from fewer children. The only reason why our population hasn't already fallen in Europe is that we're living longer. It's aging. But you can't just run a continent on old people. We really do need young people. And we're going to get, in the short term, increasing numbers of young people from outside Europe, where people have been having three or four children each. But the entire world is now below 2.5 children. Anyway, should we do the last question, which is, I think, here.
Do you in any way blame the Remain campaign for not educating or spreading your message enough when UKIP has been laying the groundwork for 30 plus years?
It wasn't just UKIP laying the groundwork. When Margaret Thatcher talked about swamping, she was laying the groundwork. I can remember the National Front in the 1970s. The National Front came into my school, actually beat me up once. The National Front collapsed in 1979 because Margaret Thatcher took the votes. So the swamp thing began with her, but to be fair, my old MP, who I really like quite a lot, David Blunkett, also decided to use the swamping word as well. I mean, Labour played this just as much. And the tabloids built it up. Now, in hindsight, you could have run a different Remain campaign and won, in hindsight. You know, there would have been ways to have done it, not least getting the police in and looking at that computer server earlier. But here's the conundrum in my head and why I'm an optimist. Supposing Remain had won by doing better messaging and so on by 52%, or even by 55%, or even say by 60%, Remain wins by 60%, Leave gets 40%. It wouldn't have been decisive. And we know that now because of the heartfelt belief of the chief funders, including the men who put their money through Northern Ireland, so we don't know who they are, the European Research Group, as they call it, the Conservative Party. This is absolutely essential for them that we leave. And if Remain had won, it wouldn't have stopped. And I think if you accept that view, it's much easier to be much happier. And anything that makes me happier, I kind of grasp at. I don't think the referendum would have been accepted if there had been a Remain win, because the Conservative Party in particular have been arguing about this since they stabbed John Major in the back, and only Margaret Thatcher could keep them in some kind of a control before then. The really important thing, I think, politically, is to explain that this came from UKIP, the National Front, and the Conservatives. This is theirs. They are the ones who decided to put in a manifesto they'd have a referendum. They're the ones who produced the majority of argument for leaving in the referendum. The Conservatives are the ones who've done the negotiations. This is a Tory Brexit. And the danger is, because the Conservatives are very good at spinning things, they'll somehow manage to say that Jeremy Corbyn was at a graveyard somewhere in Tunisia when he planned Brexit with some person he met. You know, I could just see it. And the clever thing in hindsight, I'm not saying Jeremy Corbyn is particularly clever, or those people advising him are, but the clever thing in hindsight is not to lay out your plan, but to have a plan, a really good plan, so that the minute anything happens, you instantly press the button on the next thing on the plan. And we've just learned the next thing on the plan is we will not negotiate with you unless you rule out a hard exit. And that clearly was agreed 3 or 4 weeks ago. And clearly, Jeremy Corbyn and his team, John MacDonald, have a whole series of plans all written out like a chess game of exactly what they will do in the event of everything that is likely to happen in the next few weeks. And you'll sit there and watch it. But my hope is that this carries on for a few more weeks. We'll have 7 more votes of no confidence. May May try and come back and claim it's a victory, but she doesn't get the biggest ever defeat in parliamentary history on the next kind of one. Project Fear turns into real fear. The banks realise that the secret deal they've written to go with the 585-page document is not going to work. There were only 115 words on finance in that document. 115 words on finance in the 585-page document. The bank shares begin to go faster. Barclays are already half what they were in June 2016. People realise that the housing market really has gone. It's on the BBC front page today. Estate agents who never talk about house prices going down. Today, Britain's estate agents have said it is the worst it has been for 20 years. Who's going to buy a house now if you can avoid it? And the government of the Bank of England says, and we know they're overvalued. You know, we pay more for our houses than anywhere else. My hope is that as we begin to get nearer and nearer, at some point, Theresa May will write that letter. And she will revoke Article 50 because she has to, because she actually does care a bit about people, and because her husband is a very well-connected banker who knows exactly what will happen if we crash out. And the important thing is that she writes the letter, she's revoked Article 50, they did it. It was not a Labour battalion of the British people. And that's just my little kind of wish for Christmas, is it works out that way. And she'll call it a delay, and it won't go away, and there'll be a promise of a referendum, and so on. And for the rest of your lives, if you're a bit like my mother's life, you know, she was a teenager at the times of Suez. I'm afraid the rest of her life, things got better, they got worse, and so on. But issues of power and the empire were always there. I'll do your question afterwards, because I did promise people that was the last question. Thank you very much for listening to me rant on and my weird views. I'll hang around for a few minutes if you've got anything burning to ask. I'm afraid Connor gets his copy, but it is available, and it is published by Lord Ashcroft's publisher. Lord Ashcroft owns Biteback, which means that the 10 pages of Lord Ashcroft in here, he cannot sue us about. Thank you so much.